Our reading this week is in Joshua chapter 15, if you want to grab your Bible and head over there. And my guess is that since we began this reading at the beginning of the year, everybody has been anxiously waiting for us to get to Joshua chapter 15. It's just the chapter that you have been waiting for, right?
Oh, there's good stuff here.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely getting into flyover territory for a lot of Bible readers. And I think that is our propensity, you know, like when you get down to verse number 22 or 21, and you start picking up on the fact there's going to be a list. In fact, you know, I got a whole page of list that's pretty easy to say, okay, that's where it starts, where is the end of it? And so
right.
I do think, as we are with genealogies, lists of names, we don't pause and ask the important question, why is this in the Bible?
Yeah.
And so maybe that's a beginning place for us today. If you've been tempted to think, why are we even reading this part of Joshua? Because and what can I possibly say to my kids about this? maybe that's the starting point. Why is this here? How about that?
Yeah. Well, aside from kind of standard answers like it shows the depth of God's faithfulness. Maybe these cities and villages don't matter to us, but it does show the scope and scale of God's faithfulness. Setting that aside, though, there are some things I think we can make of it. First of all, beginning of chapter 15, and notice the first verse of chapter 16, where it says the allotment of the people of Joseph, the beginning of 16. This is Judah versus Joseph, and it's interesting that it says Joseph, not Ephraim and Manasseh. It will divide it between Ephraim and Manasseh, mm-hmm. but this takes us back to Genesis, and it also takes us forward into the book of Kings, in that there is a struggle between Judah and Joseph in Genesis. We forget it was Judah's idea to get rid of him the way they did, because Judah—
You're talking about Genesis 39.
Yeah, Genesis—
When they sold him into slavery.
Genesis 37 and 39, yeah. Mm-hmm. This was really Judah versus Joseph. Joseph had kind of become Jacob's preferred firstborn. Judah would rather have that spot since Reuben and Simeon and Levi had been disowned. And so you have— and of course, eventually Jacob would bless the tribe of Judah with the scepter. But there is this struggle between the one who got the birthright and the one who would rule. And so what you see already here is that ongoing kind of already a rift in Jacob's family from Genesis. Going forward, the tribes of Joseph become the northern kingdom when they split. Samaria is centered in Ephraim. And so we already have here, even the way the land's divided up, a representation of how eventually the unity of the land will be divided between Judah and Joseph again, just like the rift that goes back to Genesis. So already hints of the two dominant tribes, if you will, the tribe of Joseph, represented in the double portion of Ephraim and Manasseh, and the tribe of Judah, already here in the land being allotted. Those, all the other tribes are just kind of hangers-on. It's really about Joseph and Judah.
Well, and really, I mean, it really becomes that during the divided kingdom.
Correct.
It's Israel in the north and Judah in the
correct.
South. So,
correct.
So, yeah, it essentially become two powers,
right,
north and south, at war with each other.
Absolutely. This rift in Jacob's family that will go on until the exile.
Yeah.
And so already, we're kind of being reminded of the two heavy hitters, Joseph and Judah, here, as in all the other tribes are just kind of along for the ride. Within this itself, though, certainly it seems a little boring. You got verses 1 through 12, which are a description of the tribal boundaries. And then verses 13 down through 62, with that final verse 63 as a commentary, yeah. An in-depth description of the cities and villages that sit within the boundaries.
Yeah, the names of people and places don't usually excite us.
No, again, except that, again, God's faithful, he keeps his word, and look at the scope of this. But there are some things in here outside the list that are worth noticing. And the two big things—
Well, let me do this first.
Yeah.
We're dealing in chapter 15 with the territory allotted to Judah.
Right.
So for the sake of just getting in your mind where that is, let me throw this slide up there. And if you look at kind of the bottom center, you see Judah in that sort of yellowish territory. That's what he's talking about here. That's the area he is describing. That is going to be the area that is settled by Judah. And so these are the places that are being talked about. So you can see the Dead Sea there. This is just to the west of that. and bordered by the Mediterranean Sea or the Great Sea on the other side. So that's the territory that we're talking about.
Yeah, and put that back up for a sec. There's a couple of the things that we ought to notice. You know, do notice that that city Jebus, which is normally where Jerusalem is, you know, this map does reflect the fact that per Joshua 15, they do not take Jerusalem. It remains a Jebusite city until David's day. And notice it sits right on the dividing line between Judah and Benjamin in the original allotment. And that's going to matter. We can talk about that in just a minute from the text here. And then the other thing to notice is the tribe of Dan is still down where it belongs originally. Eventually, they will go up and take the city of Dan.
Right.
And which was actually not called Dan at this time. The map did fudge on that one. But yeah, eventually migrate north. But originally, this map rightly reflects what we're going to read here in Joshua, which is the tribes where they originally went. And again, cities like Jerusalem, Jebus, were right on the border. So,
okay. So, coming back to chapter 15, structure the chapter. That might be helpful.
Yeah, so verses 1 through 12, actual boundary lines. This is where Judah runs. The allotment for Judah. And then starting in verse 13 with Caleb making a reappearance, you begin into a listing of the various villages and cities within that. But the big thing to notice, verse 8, the boundary goes up over the valley of the son of Hinnom, which is becomes Gehenna eventually. It's where the child sacrifice will happen in the days later on. Jeremiah will talk about this.
And that word associated with hell in the New Testament.
And becomes the Greek phrase Gehenna for hell, land of Hinnom. That valley along the southern side of what becomes Jerusalem. But you notice it's the southern shoulder of the Jebusite. That is Jerusalem because it's not Jerusalem yet. The Jebusites have control of it. But the boundary then goes up over the top of the mountain that lies over the valley of the son of Hinnom. And to the west, and so on and so forth. And then when you flip ahead, cheat a little bit to chapter 18, where the boundaries of Benjamin are given, chapter 18 and verse 16, the boundary for Benjamin goes down to the border of the mountain that overlooks the valley of the son of Hinnom, which is at the northern end of the valley of Rephaim, and then goes down to the valley of the son of Hinnom, and so forth. All that to say, we don't have to get down into exactly, get a surveyor out here and do the plot lines, but here's what's interesting. What this does, it puts what's going to become the city of Jerusalem literally right on the border between between Judah and Benjamin. Right on the border. Parts of what become Jerusalem are actually in Judahite territory. Parts of the oldest part of Jerusalem are actually going to be in Benjamite territory. Why does that matter? Because they don't take it at this time. And what's eventually going to happen is David will take it. And David uses it, God's certainly choosing to place his name there, but David's going to use this as a way of bridging the rift between Judah and Benjamin, because Benjamin was the tribe of Saul. And so a neutral capital city, David will move his capital from Hebron up to Jerusalem when he takes it, finally drives the Jebusites out, as a way of bridging old wounds and bridging the gap between the tribe of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin over the royal household. And so it's interesting that God already kind of here, God in his providence, sets up Jerusalem as a place that literally is going to be right on the border.
Yeah, literally the bridge.
Literally the bridge between the north and the south, between Judah and Benjamin, and between the ongoing struggles. Benjamin, of course, being in Joseph's orbit as another son of Rachel.
It's not unrelated. It's all connected
together. And that's why, again, we sit there and say this is boring. No, God's doing 4D chess here. And so if you understand how the stories are playing out, how the geography and the genealogies line out from Genesis all the way to Kings, you already understand how the land becomes part of the story.
Yep. Now, it's interesting to me that in the middle of this sort of listing chapter— we do get a brief narrative, which is true to the pattern in Joshua, that we don't just get the detail of conquering and settling, but there are all these stories along the way. And we return to a story, and that's Caleb's story, because if we go back, he was the one who said, hey, I want this portion that was promised to me,
right?
So I go to run the giants out of there, right?
Right.
And here he is doing that exact thing.
Right.
He's doing he's finishing the job as God wanted him to do. Go to your territory and finish up the mop-up operation.
That's right. And what's interesting about that is, again, just like we saw in chapter 14, the text here, verses 13 through was about 19, you know, again, emphasize he's taking on the Anakim, the giants. Mm-hmm. And why does that matter here? Echoes of the next guy who's this aggressive and this zealous is going to be David.
Fighting a giant.
Who fights a giant and takes Jerusalem, which is hanging around untaken in this chapter. And so, again, just little God knows what he's doing, dropping hints of the, you know, my kind of guys pop up every so often, and I reward them and I bless them. And so here's Caleb dealing with giants and taking land and springs and all of this. And eventually David's going to come and finish this story when he finishes, you know, his claim to fame, you know, being taking out a giant, one of the Anakim, and then taking Jerusalem, getting rid of the Jebusites, and kind of, you know, being Caleb's worthy successor to finishing up what started here.
I want to go aside for a minute and make the point that I think these little threads running through the tapestry that we often miss are actually powerful evidence for inspiration.
Oh, yeah.
You know, these are not guys out writing books that are disjointed and disconnected from everything else. But in reality, even in a chapter like chapter 15, we discover these pieces that thread back to Genesis and thread forward to, the Samuels and the Kings. And it's this beautiful story that's knit together. And sometimes the depth of those connections are missed because we just pass over stuff.
Oh, absolutely. No, the intertextuality is the fancy word for, you know, just kind of the
is that really a word? Intertextuality?
Yeah, with a T, intertextuality.
Inter.
I can't talk now. Intertextuality. Yeah, it's a real
word. Write that one down.
It's a real word. But no, you know, and the other thing is just, you know, Caleb's zeal is contagious, you know, because
yes,
now.
Yes, I like that.
And but what's interesting is, you know, it's kind of seems to be, you know, kind of also, you know, kind of it's a virtuous family because, you know, Caleb, you know, kind of, you know, invites others to join in, whoever strikes Kiriath Sefer and captures it, you know, I'll give Aksa my daughter. And it's Othniel, son of Kenaz, the brother of Caleb, you know. So again, just this, you know, it's just a very virtuous clan. You know, sometimes it really does kind of run in families. And then, you know, once Othniel does his bit, you know, and gets Aksa's hand in marriage, here's Aksa, the daughter of Caleb, saying, "More land, more, you know, just let's keep doing this, let's keep stacking land." And so again, just the zeal, and that language of blessing hanging over this, the zeal to rid the land of the enemies of the Lord. You know, it becomes a source of blessing. You know, it's not selfish. It's very much a participation in God's promises and in driving out the enemies of the land. You know, that way we talk about the apparent genocide that God calls for. It's really not. It's God's judgment on his enemies.
Right. Yeah, and that's always a funny thing to me that people object to things like that.
Yeah.
And yet they would also, if you back up and these people are literally offering infants as a sacrifice to God, critics would say, why doesn't God do something about that? So it kind of reminds me of Habakkuk, you know, people say, oh, this is an outrage. Why didn't somebody do something about that? And God says, well, okay, here's what I'm going to do. Well, that's an outrage. How can you do something like that? God's going to get criticized no matter
that's
what he
exactly
does.
That's exactly right.
But God is God, and he is not subject to our judgment
that's
about
right.
what he does.
That's right. And generally when we start, you know, casting stones on God's ways, it's, you know, because we think we can make up the rules of morality. Or then realizing by definition God is moral, and so my job is to learn to see how this is in fact consistent with the nature and character of God.
Yeah, because we've done so much better making up morals
without
God. Yeah,
that's exactly right.
So I do like here the way that it seems to me Caleb is inspiring.
Yeah.
In this case, someone else, Othniel, to go and to be a partaker in this, and it just occurs to me that whatever you are is contagious.
Yeah. Yeah, evil companions can corrupt good morals the other direction.
Yeah, you know, here Caleb, and you could just kind of sense when you read this, the spirit of Caleb, how passionate he was, fixated he was on finishing the work of God, and that's infecting others around him. But it's going to work the other way, too.
Sure.
And this sort of indifference and passiveness about finishing the job will be infectious and impact others too, because that's where the chapter is going to end.
Right.
You know, with a sort of somber indication of things to come. And
right.
That is, you know, there's part of this they didn't finish the mop up operation.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't done. And the reason I bring that out is because I think this, the same thing is always true among God's people. I think it's true among God's people today. People that are excited and passionate about the work of the Lord tend to inspire the people around them to do the same. But if I'm a negative grumbler critic that discourages people,
Right.
You know, that becomes infectious too. I pass that down to my children. And so I think we really need to ponder what kind of spirit we bring to the things, to the work of God. That would be a great thing to talk to your kids about in this chapter. So what kind of spirit am I going to replicate?
Yeah.
Because I do think we tend to do that.
Yeah.
You know, I think we've all talked to someone and thought, man, I can hear his father's voice in him.
Right.
Good or bad. Or, wow, I could see her mother in her. Good or bad.
Right.
Tend to pass on
right.
the spirit we have toward God and toward his word.
You know, and the thing about Caleb and too is it's contagious, especially in his family, you know, that husbands and fathers set the tone for their families. And so here's Caleb with a, you know, with a nephew who's this way, who with a brother who's this way, with a daughter who's this way, because of who he is and how he's lived, and it's contagious even within his own family. He sets the tone for his entire clan with his zeal.
Okay, so a little bit more than we thought about in chapter 15, huh? not just a list. Let's encourage you to think about those broader connections back to Genesis and to other places in the Old Testament, and as well to ponder the Caleb example and how it potentially impacts my own life. What kind of spirit do I bring to the work, and how's that affecting others? Let's think about that as we work in this chapter this week.